Our freedom of conscience and religion is being challenged by laws and regulations imposed by secular society. It's time to hear from the top Christian litigators in the nation who have come forward to tell us the truth and help us defend our faith. Welcome to Faith on Trial with Defender of the Faith, Deacon Mike Mano.
Hear ye, hear ye. All rise. Faith on Trial with Defender of the Faith, Deacon Mike Mano, is in session.
And good Tuesday morning from the Mercy Live Up studio in West Des Moines. I'm Deacon Mike Mano, and welcome to Faith on Trial, where we examine the influence of law and society on people of faith. Joining us today, we Dr. Martin Parsons, head of the research wing of the Barnabas Fund, who will be discussing not only what the Barnabas Fund is, for those of us who don't know, but a new report by the British government that would force various religious institutions to teach LGBT as part of what's loosely referred to as queer theology. And then we'll get a debriefing of sorts on the baby Charlie Gard case from Laura Wenman, chair of the Ethics Committee at Mercy Hospital. And don't forget, we have a new text line if you have any comments or questions, 515-223-1150. And good morning, Pam. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm fine. Enjoying the weather.
Yeah, the weather is kind of nice.
Oh, it's perfect. And, you know, we assume it won't last because the fair is coming right around the corner, and it's always beastly hot for
beastly
the fair.
Hot. Well, like
you can count on that.
Like I've said before, the nice thing about it getting hot in July is my grass doesn't grow that fast,
I know.
And I don't have to mow. Do you have a prayer to open us up with?
I do. It's our prayer for peace today. God of peace, bring your peace to our violent world. Peace in the hearts of all men and women, and peace among the nations of the earth. Turn to your way of love those whose hearts and minds are consumed with hatred. Strengthen us in hope and give us the wisdom and courage to work tirelessly for a world where true peace and love reign among nations and in the hearts of all. Amen.
Amen. Thank you very much, Pam. You have to remember that we are on the air here courtesy of our loyal sponsors and underwriters, one of them being Confluence Brewing Company off the bike trail just south of Gray's Lake at 1235 Thomas Beck Road, where there's live entertainment in the tap room every Thursday. And this Thursday, it's Patricia Hartman.
We also want to thank Robert Cota, Farm Bureau Financial Services at 200 West 2nd Avenue down in Indianola, 515-961-4555. And we also want to thank all of those loyal listeners who are giving their donations monthly, weekly, whatever that might be. We're very grateful for your support.
This is a listener-supported station.
Amen.
And we hope, and if you don't have money, we can always take your prayers.
Oh, prayers always.
To keep us on the air. All right. Over across the pond in merry old England, there is a new report that has come out, and it's from a report from something called Wilton Park, which is an agency of the United Kingdom Foreign and Commonwealth Office, which is basically asking that Christian organizations, as they advocate overseas, that are affiliated with the Great Britain, that they, I guess the best way to describe it is that there should be a reinterpretation of Scripture so that the LGBT ideas are reflected in that. And one of the critics of that is a organization called the Barnabas Fund. And we have with us the director of research for the Barnabas Fund, Dr. Martin Parsons, who's over in England this morning. And good morning, doctor. What time is it over there, by the way?
It's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and a very bright, sunny afternoon it is here, too. And good morning to you and to all your listeners.
Good morning, and I love the accent. We can tell we're talking overseas.
And we love yours, too.
Oh, that's good.
That's right. It is an accent. We come from them, remember?
That's right. Thank you for joining us today.
Let's talk a little bit about the Barnabas Fund so that people can understand what it is. And we do have on our blog, we do have a link to that. But why don't you tell us a little bit about what the Barnabas Fund is and what it does.
Sure, thank you. Barnabas Fund was set up just over 20 years ago to support persecuted Christians, particularly in the Islamic world. That was the point at which the main source of persecution was in switching over from the communist world to the Islamic world. But we've also always been concerned to keep an eye on freedom in our own backyard, because if we don't keep up the seawall here, then clearly we can't speak about persecution overseas. So it's quite important to us to talk about persecution in the West, and we have offices in UK, USA, Australia, New Zealand, and we work in about 50 countries in the world.
Okay, so you have a global reach for the Barnabas Fund.
That's right, yeah. And as I say, we're interested in particularly supporting the persecuted church in the Islamic world, but of course we're also concerned to protect freedom of religion in countries like the UK and the USA, so that we can continue to speak about freedom of religion.
Good. Now, there was a report by Wilton Park, and I guess Wilton Park is not the name of an individual. It is a division of the foreign, I guess, office of the British government.
Yeah, basically this is a think tank that is part of the UK Foreign Office, so it would be a little bit like a think tank that was sponsored by the US State Department, and this came up with a number of recommendations which, frankly, we were horrified when we read them.
So were we. So let's go over some of them. What are they recommending here?
Right. Essentially, they were talking about the status of LGBT people in the global south. But rather than aiming for a sort of state of mutual coexistence between Christians and LGBT activists, where each could persuade them peacefully of their own truth claims, this was a kind of winner-takes-all, we want to enforce LGBT beliefs and ideology on Christians. It particularly focused on evangelical Christians, but, you know, whatever they say about evangelicals, you can apply to Catholics as well.
Sure.
So they were saying things like, Christians need to reinterpret the Bible. They need to reinterpret the scripture. They need to teach LGBT beliefs in Sunday schools. They need to teach queer theology in theological seminaries. And we looked at this and we thought, well, actually, you know, that kind of imposition of ideology on churches, that's pretty similar to what's happening in China, where, you know, the theological seminaries have to teach a theology that's approved in terms of state ideology and so forth. So this would be a massive imposition and a reversal of freedom of religion if it was to be implemented. And, you know, our particular concern was, yes, we know that there are groups that will come out with these sort of ideas, but this was an organization that was officially part of the UK Foreign Office that was publishing these ideas. So it was almost like state-sponsored advocacy of this.
Wow.
So was it kind of like under the radar until you guys sort of took a notice of what was going on?
That's exactly what it is, yeah. And,
wow,
you know, there is a wider agenda here. We are seeing this in a number of countries in the Western world of basically attempts to impose LGBT ideology on wider society, including Christians and churches. You know, we're not talking about tolerance and mutual coexistence. We're talking about attempts to impose an ideology. And, you know, this is a huge reversal of freedom of religion. Now, you very kindly mentioned at the beginning that, you know, we both Brits and Americans come from the same kind of stock. Well, in 1559, so we're going way back before U.S. independence.
Yeah, I don't remember it myself, but go ahead.
yeah. I'm not quite that old either, but there was an act of Parliament in the U.K. that basically said, this is what the state's allowed to do. This is what the church is allowed to do. And the state's not allowed to encourage anyone to have allegiance to a foreign power. And in turn, the state may not impose a particular interpretation of Scripture. So what we're talking about is turning the clock back 450 years or so. You know, this is huge, but it comes about partly because we've forgotten our history and our history of the heritage of freedom of religion that the English-speaking people spread across the world.
Yeah, let's. I guess this is, in effect, an attempt by government to impose religious beliefs. And of course,
that's exactly it. Yeah, and I mean, what's really interesting is, you know, between 1719 and 1888, the UK abolished various test acts that said you had to hold certain religious beliefs in order to hold public office or stand for election. The USA became independent in the middle of that period and quickly wrote into the Constitution separation of church and state, and there must be no test act. What we're seeing, though, is a kind of backdoor movement to kind of impose a worldview, a set of ideological beliefs that people have to hold to be in public office or to stand for election. And that's this sort of imposition of an ideology.
Well, the language was really strong here, that if you didn't teach these beliefs or if you didn't agree with them, you were a disseminator of hate and intolerant.
That's right. And, you know, it was actually worse than that. The portrayal of the African church was frankly racist. African Christians were portrayed as unable to interpret the Bible for themselves. They'd just imbibed these ideas from, I'm afraid they said, North American missionaries. You know, and essentially, it was a racist, denigratory portrayal of African Christians. And that's completely unacceptable.
The more we see and hear the language of tolerance, it seems like there's a lot of intolerance going on.
Yeah, and I think there's a very subtle shift of language that's going on here because, you know, when I was at school, tolerance, and if you look in the dictionary, it says tolerance means tolerating of views that you disagree with.
Right.
Allowing people to have and express views you disagree with. What we're increasingly seeing is when people talk about tolerance, they're requiring people to sign up to a set of socially liberal principles. And if you don't sign up to those, you are deemed to be intolerant. Well, actually, the only intolerance is people who won't accept other people's right to hold those beliefs and express them.
Thank you.
And we see that here a lot. It's not necessarily coming from a government edict, but from a lot of court rulings where, you know, we have people over here that, for example, bakers that don't want to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding because they don't believe in it, being hauled
sure.
into court. And being told that they have to do this the same way with florists. And now we have some stories later on we'll be talking about in our news segment where people are being forced to promote ideas that they don't believe in because they're a film company, for example, that does for spec does videos. And then they're being required, well, if an LGBT group comes in and wants a pro-LGBT video, they have to do it. And so you're right. We are confusing the word tolerance now with a mandatory acceptance, really.
Well, I'm very interested you picked up on the Baker's issue because, yeah, those two instances, I think, in Colorado and Oregon, we had a similar one that followed on from that, and I suspect was actually probably deliberately copying that in Belfast in Northern Ireland, where there was an attempt to introduce gay marriage. It failed, and the LGBT community very much blamed Christians for it. And in the week following, somebody walked into a bakery that advertised itself as a Christian business and ordered a cake promoting gay marriage. It was politely declined, but they took them to court, supported by the Government Equality Commission. And as soon as they did that, there was not just a huge furore happened, but this Christian couple, young couple with two very young children, were subject to a huge amount of hate crime, hate mail, They received death threats, arson threats.
My golly.
They had huge damage to one of their bakeries. You know, we were seeing violence against Christians. And when gay marriage was legalized a couple of years ago in the UK, we saw the same pattern. Anyone who expressed moderately phrased disagreement with this was likely to receive hate mail, death threats. The Archbishop of York, who was from Uganda, he received racist abuse because of it. And there was a, you know, there's another story here of actually when governments start to promote that kind of imposition of an ideological agenda, unfortunately, you get a few people who are within that minority group who decide to use violence. And, you know, nobody is denying that the LGBT community themselves suffer huge amounts of hate crime, but there are people within that community who are actually also using violence and threats of violence against Christians.
Yes, and we've seen bakers run out of business, photographers run out of business. Now, the Colorado case that you referred to has just been accepted by our Supreme Court. So that case is going to be heard, and my guess is there's a case coming up from Washington with a florist that they're going to combine those two cases and hear them both at the same time. So maybe we'll get something definitive from the Supreme Court. But in the meantime, again, we see this over and over again where people are denigrated for holding fast to Christian beliefs, and they're called names. And I noticed that in the report, one of the reports that you put out, it talk about missionaries being described as spreading prejudicial views, and evangelical Christians are described as spreading hatred. And again, the use of the terminology and the language, you know, this is 1984 Newspeak stuff.
Yes, it is. And often, you know, there is that redefinition of language. You know, terms like equality no longer seem to mean equality. In fact, just today, there was a court case going on in the UK. There was a Christian magistrate on a adoption panel. And he expressed the view that, quote, generally speaking, it's best for children to have a mother and a father, end quote.
What a heretical view,
no.
Right?
Yeah.
Because he said that, there were complaints made that he was prejudiced against people who were same-sex relationships. He was sacked as a magistrate. But then, on top of that, the hospital where he was a non-executive director then suspended him and got rid of him for something that was nothing to do with the hospital. Now, that case is now going to court today. But essentially what we're seeing is it comes back to this attempt to impose a test act that you have to sign up to certain beliefs to hold public office. And in a sense, the USA is in a slightly better position than the UK because you've got that part of the US Constitution saying no test act. Mm-hmm. But it's still open to interpretation by judiciary who, you know, in past generations, they made common law decisions that were based very much on Judeo-Christian values. Now it's based on a whole set of very different values.
Yeah, we see that. You talk about the magistrate. We had a judge, a magistrate, I think it was in Utah, indicated that she did not wish to perform same-sex weddings. And she was disciplined by the judicial commission in her state. And we've seen in Massachusetts there was a doctor, and he taught at Harvard Medical School. But he was working in a hospital, and he sent out a little memo to his colleagues on the hospital staff about some of the medical dangers to homosexual activity, and he was disciplined and fired for that. Now, you know, this is somebody that's talking about medicine and talking about medical facts, but apparently it's not enough anymore to speak the truth. You've got to speak the politically correct truth.
Yeah, and, you know, this is, there's a wider set of issues here. It is not simply freedom of religion. There are wider issues of freedom of speech that are hugely important, that, you know, our democracies are based on these. Democracy works on the basis that instead of killing each other and fighting each other when we disagree, we debate things. But if you can't debate things because there isn't freedom of speech, you know, you can't actually have democracy functioning properly.
Right.
You've got to have freedom of speech. Yeah, we have to be able to debate. You know, I should be able to sit down with a Muslim friend or a gay friend or anyone else, and we should be able to have a discussion, not come to blows, but have a discussion and disagree well. That's how democracy works. And we accept the results when we vote on something. What we're increasingly seeing, though, is a whole series of bullying and intimidation to say, you cannot even discuss these things. And if you're an academic, you can't even research those things. Now, that fundamentally undermines democracy.
Interestingly, yeah, that you use the term bullying, because I think that's where a lot of this stuff started from, was that whole concept of those type of folks being bullied. And it's completely done a little role reversal here. I have a question to you also about the report that said they suggested that there should be some revisions in the Bible. This is the first time I've seen something like that. It wasn't just so much what was being said, is now this whole recommendation of rewriting the Bible. What was your reaction to that? And does this Wilton Park group have a lot of traction over there?
It's one of those things that when you see a report like this, you actually think twice. If we write about this, are we going to give this more traction and a little bit more publicity?
Okay.
Or would it be better not to say anything about this? But at the end of the day, you know, if you don't say anything, we see the direction of travel. We see more and more attempts to impose this sort of ideology on Christians. We have to take a stand on that. And yet, my reaction when I saw that, you know, Christians in the global south, and they were particularly talking about Africa, should reinterpret the Bible to make it compatible with LGBT beliefs. Do you know, in Uganda, which is, I think, probably one of their key countries they're talking about, under Idi Amin, the archbishop was summoned to see Idi Amin, the dictator, and told, I want you to cut all references to Israel out of the Bible. They were told to reinterpret the Bible. Now imagine what that's like if you're a Ugandan Christian and you suddenly hear the British Foreign Office saying, well, we published this report that Christians should reinterpret the Bible. You know, Christians in the global south, when we talk to them, they view these sorts of things as a form of colonialism.
Sure.
And that's their words.
Wow. Well, it's a global fight, and we've all got to step up. Why don't you tell us again how people might contact the Barnabas Fund and to get more information?
Sure. If you go onto the website, it's barnabasfund.org, and you'll see there that a little bit at the top of the page where you can click a particular flag, and if you click the U.S. flag, it will give you news particularly about the USA, and we have an office just outside Washington.
Very good. And I think there's a place on there where you can make donations if you want to contribute to their work.
That's right. Yeah. You know, but do pray. Yeah. Prayer, as you said earlier, you know, of course we need money to help Christians overseas, but prayer is the thing that's really, really important.
Thank you for joining us today. We certainly appreciate you and appreciate your work, and we'll keep you in our prayers.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
God bless you. Thanks again.
Dr. Martin Parsons, who is Director of Research for the Barnabas Fund. We'll be back in 2 minutes after these messages.
At Golden Rule Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling, we put your mind at ease with the Gold Club membership. I'm Bobby from Golden Rule, where our Gold Club members get automatic twice-a-year system checks, a full plumbing inspection, no trip charges, and front-of-the-line service. At Golden Rule Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling, we obey the 5 rules to live by every single day. We deliver respect, understanding, loyalty, expertise, and service every time you call. Home is where your heart is. The Gold Club membership helps you protect it. Online at goldenrulephc.com.
Support for The Uncommon Good is provided by Cartridge World. Cartridge World is an industry leader delivering high-performance printing products that help you save time, money, and print great.
Perfect for businesses, home offices, college students, or busy moms trying to find affordable printing supplies, including ink, toner, paper, or printers. For business customers, pickup and delivery are available. Products are guaranteed or full replacement.
Cartridge World, your low-cost, environmentally friendly printing experts. 801 73rd Street in Windsor Heights, 515-564-7400, and online at cartridgeworld.com.
Strength, stability, service, and Robert Cota. That's what you can count on with Farm Bureau Financial Services. Robert Cota, your Farm Bureau agent in Central Iowa. Here to help people like you through all stages of life. He can make it simple to help protect what is most important to you, your family, cars, home, and future. Farm Bureau makes insurance simple. Robert Cota, 515-961-4555, or online at robert.cota@fbfs.com.
Farm Bureau Life Insurance Company, Farm Bureau Property and Casualty Insurance Company.
Iowa Catholic Radio wants to congratulate the Dowling Boys baseball and girls softball teams on a tremendous 2017 season. While the season was filled with its challenges, each team persevered to not only make the postseason tournament, but also made runs at the championship. We would like to thank our sponsors, Correll Contractor, Ag Solver, CTI Ready Mix, Liguri Insurance Agency, and the Ball Team for their support of our inaugural season broadcasting Dowling baseball and softball. Congratulations to the Dowling Boys and girls for their fantastic seasons, only on Iowa Catholic Radio.
On Iowa Catholic Radio, I'm Deacon Mike Manon. I'm here with Pat Burdell, my co-host, and we're welcoming in right now Lauren Wendman, who is the chairman of the Ethics Committee at Mercy Hospital. She's also chief of mission there. We'll let her explain what that all means to you in just a second. And we want to do a little debriefing, I guess, of the baby Charlie Gard case and talk a little bit about end-of-life issues with an ethicist. Is that how you pronounce it?
Ethicist.
See, I'm not built for radio. Laura, how are you?
Morning. I'm fine. I hope all are well there, too.
We are. We are. Thank you. All right. First of all, let's explain this chief of mission, because we were talking yesterday, and I thought that was very interesting concept.
Sure. Well, it's a term that's maybe unique in other places, but it's certainly not unique in Catholic institutions. I am the chief mission officer, which was a position in times when we had the religious sisters gracing our halls, always had somebody in that role who was a religious woman. But now I'm the second lay person to have this position at Mercy Medical Center. And really, among a number of things, my responsibility is upholding Catholic teaching and Catholic tradition in a Catholic healthcare setting with the assistance of my colleagues.
Very good. And now that brings us up, I guess, to the question at hand today. And we've all been watching this Charlie Gard case over in Great Britain, and we've seen them pull life support from this baby. And so the question comes up now, is it ever appropriate to pull life support? And what is the Catholic Church teaching on some of these end-of-life issues that we run into, and many of us will run into them in our own families.
Like, sure.
When do you have a do not resuscitate order? When do you decide that enough is enough and we just can't go any further? And how do we make those decisions?
Well, it's certainly a difficult choice, and it's a difficult choice especially because you're often deciding maybe for yourself or for those you love, and so there's a lot of emotion involved, which I think is what captured the attention of the world in regards to Charlie Gard. You know, fortunately for us here at Mercy and for families around the world, the cases like Charlie Gard are unusual and rare. His disease that he had was rare. And so, again, it captures a lot of media attention, but the more practical thing for your listeners to be thinking about really, in terms of end of life, especially in regards to Catholic teaching, is that the Catholicism really enforces and reinforces in us, and certainly us as a Catholic healthcare institution, that the value of each person is intrinsic, that the person is irreplaceable, and that they possess an inherent dignity as a human being, regardless of their medical condition, regardless of a disability they may have, regardless of a disease process that may be underway. And if you start with that as your foundation, it makes it a little bit easier to navigate some of those difficult decisions.
I think that's a key point. And I think you folks do a really good job of educating families and individuals with that information as you go about your day, trying to prepare folks with advanced directives and whatnot so that they can have some kind of hand in what direction that they would like to see things go for themselves.
Yeah, I think so. And I thank you, Pam, for that compliment. I think part of that there's a document that is crafted and continuously updated by the Conference of Catholic Bishops called the Ethical and Religious Directives for Catholic Healthcare. And that is a supplemental document that, unlike secular hospitals, it gives us guidance in accord to church teaching. And we review that. We educate our physicians on it. We educate our staff. And as I go out and I talk to groups, you know, we kind of demystify that document. Sometimes people think about it in terms of all the things that the church doesn't do, you know, kind of the book of no. But I feel about it very differently. I see it as a really grace-filled document that talks about the sanctity of human life and the positive obligations that we have in Catholic health care to ensure that that life is treated with value and that we do what we can to alleviate suffering in the context of health care, and that we journey along with patients and their families when they are making difficult situations and when they're embracing situations of joy, too, which we are blessed that both of those things happen in our healthcare setting.
Let's turn to the obvious question, and that's when to withdraw life support. This is a tough one. We saw it with the Charlie Gard case. What are the church's directives, or what are the guidelines that we want to think about when we're faced with the decision of whether Uncle Ned is going to be kept on life support or not?
Sure. Well, I guess I would start by debunking one of the greatest misnomers that has happened in my tenure at Mercy, and people who perhaps don't have an understanding will say to me, well, I don't know if I want to spend the end of life in a Catholic hospital because they'll keep me connected to machines at all cost. And that's clearly not true. We, I think, as a church, embrace the fact that death is an inevitable thing. Bishop Sharon always used to say, none of us get out of here alive, right? And so we face the reality of death with the confidence of faith. And so we recognize that this is part of what we will all experience. But what people are often afraid of is that process, right? And how that death will occur and how they make good decisions, especially if they're making them on behalf of someone else. So I would begin by saying that as the condition of a patient changes, therefore so do the facts and the options that are available to you. So when I have a loved one say to me, I promised my mom I would do everything, and let's say mom has cancer, what might be available as everything on that everything list is different, you know, maybe 4 months prior to death and then 2 months prior to death and a month prior to death. Because as the disease process takes hold, the clinical factors change. And so I think that that's an important thing, that people don't come into this process with only one option in their mind, because the world will change. And they need to be constantly reassessing the facts that are there. It also sometimes takes some time for the heart and the head to reach the same conclusion. And I think that happened in the case of Charlie Gard. Those loving parents who were advocating for their son continued to get additional clinical information that at the end said, you know, they said, the time has come. And it doesn't mean that they loved their son any less or that they were giving up, but the facts that were presented to them were undeniable, and their heart and their head had reached the same place. And we mourn with them, and we're sorry for them, But sometimes our responsibility as healthcare providers is to give the family a little bit of space to have those two wonderful organs of brain and heart, you know, reach consensus. And there's also a pretty significant difference, Mike, as we think about the difference between withholding treatment, because we are intentionally intending to hasten death, right?
Right.
And when you forego treatment that is no longer beneficial. So I think oftentimes when we talk about a respirator or equipment that is an artificial means of life support, the church doesn't ever teach that just because we have the technology, we have to use it, right? It says that we must evaluate the circumstances, use prayer and wisdom and discernment to say what is it that, you know, is coming to pass here, and is there any benefit of this treatment, or are we simply allowing a machine to keep up what, if that didn't exist, nature would take its course. And I always say to folks when they ask me about some of the challenges, when I've seen one ethics case, I've seen one ethics case. You know, there's some fundamental things that are obviously our foundations, but we really try and work with each family and assess what's going on with them and with their belief system one at a time.
One of the, I suppose, the more frequent things that come up, at least has come up in my law practice, because I've dealt in with guardianships and dealing in court with court approval to do this or to do that. The one question that seems to come up a lot involves the do not resuscitate order.
Mm-hmm.
And you might want to explain that for us and what the effect is and when we might want to use something like that.
Sure. I would say that when I have a family member who has an elderly, you know, parent or somebody that they love who is very physically frail, we do have some conversation with them about what resuscitation means to them. Unfortunately, because of the popularity of medical dramas on television, they witness in an hour episode that somebody's very sick and near death, and they have a few compressions on their chest, and they're back living a normal life tomorrow.
And they're playing tennis the next
day. That's correct. And that is a very unlikely scenario. And so you just have to be truthful and be loving in saying, this is what might transpire. And your loved one is frail, and maybe there's some underlying disease process going on, and we may break their ribs when we're doing compressions. And that doesn't mean that we won't do it, but you need to know what the outcomes might be. And they're very seldom going to return to the life and the health that they had at the time that that procedure occurred.
Exactly.
It's kind of like a stair step, right, going downward. And so our responsibility in being loving and, again, to you know, if you think about compassion is to suffer with, to travel that journey with family members, is to just be as impartial in giving them the facts as we can. And, you know, we've had families who say, we want to do it, we want to do everything, we want them to be, you know, a full resuscitation, and it gets right down to it, and they change their mind and say, no, you know, we see that this is going to be a peaceful death, and we're going to let, you know, nature take its course and them be turned to the hands of God, you know, and there's no right or wrong decision. Again, it's one that needs to be taken with a great deal of seriousness, but also to say what is our goal? You know, if our goal is to have mom back, you know, and tending to her tomato garden, that might not happen no matter what we do.
Right. The advantage to having an advance directive is that you have someone who has some knowledge about what potentially could happen. You don't wait till the life and death scenario, and so you can have things pretty much in place with the hospital ahead of time as to what you see would be most beneficial to you. Do you folks have on the website any kind of information regarding advanced directives that folks could go and do a little research?
We do, Pam. There is a copy of an advanced directive on our website. You can also find them in a number of places. The Iowa Bar Association has some documents that you can print off and look. And I always say the best time to have that conversation with those you love is when you're well.
Exactly.
Right? So you're talking maybe to your aging parents, or you're talking to your spouse, or you're talking to your children about what it is that I would want when there isn't the high emotion that occurs either in an emergency or in an extended illness. And it is very, very frequent that I will talk to adult children and they will say, we know that Dad is near death, but we don't want him to know. And then I'll go in and talk to Dad, and Dad will say, I know I'm near death, but I don't want my kids to know.
Yeah.
You know, that's the loving relationship between the two, and it's a difficult conversation to have, but it doesn't get any easier if you don't have it. So
now,
I would encourage.
Now, do you provide any outreach for what I'm talking or thinking of here is speakers to go out and talk on these topics? So if Knights of Columbus group or Rosary group or something wants a speaker to come in, do you provide that?
We do, and we do through Mercy, but also the diocese has taken a great lead and developed a supportive coalition of people throughout the community who have an interest and an aptitude in this topic. And so there are a number of people who are being trained in the diocese that can talk within their own parishes or help maybe, you know, fellow parishioners to think about what they might want.
And wonderful.
And you get that from either the diocesan website or from your website.
That's correct.
And what is that, Laura, for folks who don't maybe know?
www.mercydesmoines.org.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's been very enlightening.
It has been.
It's my pleasure.
Laura Wendham, thank you. The chairman of the Ethics Committee at Mercy Hospital. I hear the music, so we're going to take another break. We'll be back again in another 2 minutes.
Thank you, Bozen the Forest, for underwriting my show, Catholic Connection, and also for your great support of Iowa Catholic Radio for more than 10 years.
Flowers are a timeless gift. At Bozen the Florist, we believe in providing the best services all over the globe. Hi, this is Tom Bozen, and we've opened a new store in West Des Moines at West Glen Town Center. With Bozen's, you get fresh flowers 24-7 with same-day delivery anywhere in the world or around the corner. No rush, no fuss. 515-244-ROSE or online at Bozen.com.
Hey friends, John Linetti here, and I want to thank Plaza Dental Group for underwriting my show. Plaza Dental Group makes their patients feel comfortable and right at home, like one of the family. Catholic owned, they offer cosmetic dentistry and implants, 6-month smiles, and Invisalign, an alternative to traditional braces, along with mercury-free dentistry. Plaza Dental Group, comfortable dentistry. 515-344-3523. Online at dmsmiles.com.
Support for Faith on Trial with Defender of the Faith, Deacon Mike Mano, is provided by
Confluence Brewing Company, brewed locally and featuring regular, seasonal, and limited-release beers available in their tap room and at local stores, bars, and restaurants. Confluence Brewing Company is found at 1235 Thomas Beck Road, off the bike trail south of Graves Lake, and online at confluencebrewing.com.
Confluence Brewing Company is a proud supporter of Faith on Trial and Iowa Catholic Radio.
Thank you, Caldwell Parish Funeral Home and Crematory, for underwriting Catholic Answers Live. Caldwell Parish is now offering the Des Moines Catholic Family Plan, funeral packages for Des Moines Catholic families that assures the final plans include all essential elements of the Catholic funeral. The Des Moines Catholic Family Plan, 515-276-0551, or online at dmcatholicfamilyplan.com. Caldwell Parish Funeral Home and Crematory, Des Moines' only Catholic-owned and operated funeral home.
And we are back with the news. Today in Grand Rapids, Michigan, the Alliance Defending Freedom is in federal court on behalf of the Young Americans for Liberty chapter and its members at Kellogg Community College in Battle Creek. in a lawsuit against the school. The ADF is arguing for a motion that was filed last May that asked for the school's speech policy to be suspended after campus security arrested three people handing out copies of the U.S. Constitution while talking with students about the club on a sidewalk. The school claims that the club supporters violated two policies. One states that students must obtain permission from the school before they engage in any expressive activity anywhere on campus, including the distribution of any written material. It also prohibits any speech as does not support the mission of Kellogg Community College or the mission of a reorganized college entity or activity. The other policy prevents students from engaging in expressive activities in any outdoor location. The lawsuit that was filed by ADF argues that these policies are unconstitutional because they grant college officials too much discretion to restrict the content and viewpoint of student speech.
We see this over and over again on college campuses where this is where you would have that as an expectation of a lot of conversation and freely being given and handed out. And this on the Constitution is just,
well,
you know,
this kind of follows up on what the doctor was talking about, Martin Parsons, at the beginning of
control
the program. Right, yeah.
Over stuff like that. Yeah, it isn't right. Well, we've got more of some of the same here. In Madison, Wisconsin, we have Amy Lawson, who is a local photographer, and her studio are being required to create photographs and blog posts, promoting pro-abortion groups and same-sex marriages. So if she creates content that promotes pro-life organizations and that celebrates the marriage of one man and one woman, she's got to do for the other. The law also forbid creative professionals from posting a statement on their website explaining that the artist reserves discretion not to use their artistic talents to promote messages or causes that are inconsistent with their deepest convictions. So to me, that would be like giving folks a heads up. Don't bother coming to me here for what you have interest in, because this isn't going to fly with me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now you're being contested to even have that. The lawsuit contends that the Madison and state laws violate the Wisconsin Constitution's guarantees of free speech, freedom of conscience, and equal protection, in addition to other protections. And yes, yes, and yes, they've totally construed this law for creative professionals and trying to endorse and promote messages that are in conflict with their conscience.
Well, and that's, again, what we talked about in the first part of the program this morning, happening over in England in a more heavy-handed fashion, perhaps.
Yeah.
But this is the extension of what's going on.
On this one, there's some significant penalties. She's subject to some fines, $500 a day per day, as long as this is going on. And up to $10,000 and maybe a business license suspension or revocation.
That's
I'm speechless.
That's right. But that's what's going on in Wisconsin.
It's Madison, Wisconsin,
right,
folks.
And then right next door in Minnesota, in the name of tolerance, the Minnesota Department of Education has recently approved a toolkit that directs schools to segregate students who are uncomfortable with sharing restrooms and locker rooms with transgender classmates. The goal of the toolkit is to help school districts and charter schools create school environments where transgender and gender nonconforming students are safe, supported, and fully included, and have equal access to the educational opportunities provided to all students as required by law. So what they're doing here is they're saying that instead of taking the people who are gender nonconforming and say, okay, you're a small group, we'll handle you this way, what they're saying is you people are all going to be mainstreamed, and the people who have legitimate
problems
privacy concerns, we're going to segregate them.
Well, you're driven by the whole bathroom business here and the locker room business, that it gets to be a free-for-all because you can decide how you want to be for a day and go wherever you will without any kind of concern. And now
there's no correlation, I guess, of having everybody be together or sameness. It's like you said, and again, the tolerance issue completely gets redefined.
Yeah, and one of the things, and again, this is something that we've talked about on the air for several years here, is when you're opening up restrooms and bathroom facilities and locker facilities and after gym locker showers to people who claim to be transgender, there's no requirement that they prove anything or that they show anything. Now, we know gender dysphoria is a legitimate psychological problem. And people who are suffering from that and who are being treated for that, you know, our prayers and everything go with them, because it is certainly, I'm sure, not comfortable to be sitting around as you believe in the wrong body. But on the other hand, the way these programs work in the schools and as articulated by government officials is all you have to do is say, well, I feel like a girl today. You don't have to show any medical documentation. And in some cases, the old Obama guidelines that were given out through the Department of Education were that when you showed up and said, I feel like a girl today, that they could not tell your parents. So the people that would be closest to you, that would be the most concerned about you and would want to get you help, can't do anything because they don't know anything. They've been shut out. And yet tomorrow you can come back and say, okay, I'm a guy today, you know, and it's just.
Well, and the more that they're required to talk about this stuff at this young age, there are going to be more and more children who don't know who they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
I mean, it used to be it was kind of okay, and you'd have maybe a few that were probably like this. But now, when you put this in the hands of the teachers and stuff, it gets to just be a bit much.
And again, another thing that we've had in the program before is we have laws in some states now that if a child, a minor child, goes to a licensed therapist or counselor and says, I'm having problems with gender identity, the counselor is required to affirm their homosexuality and to not to give them the normal consultation
kind of
counseling that they would normally have given to them. So again, and you know, we talked to John Parsons here at the beginning of the hour. These are things that are worldwide now.
Yes, this isn't just in
our not just in our backyard. It's all over.
No. And the challenge, I think, here too is for the teachers trying to deal with who all they've got. I mean, it's beyond trying to come in and teach them something.
Mm-hmm.
You're dealing with all of this other business and how you're supposed to call individual students, the whole pronoun thing.
Oh, yeah. And there's an ordinance in New York that if you don't call the person by the right pronoun,
so when you're doing roll call, how do you call who? What their name are is, and
I think we have collectively lost our common sense.
It's overwhelming. Okay, we have a Trump appoints a pro-life governor to protect freedom worldwide. This is a huge positive for today, out of Washington D.C. And this was just on the LifeSite News yesterday. President Trump has appointed one of the most pro-life and pro-natural marriage advocates to an ambassadorship designed to protect the rights of religious people the world over. Kansas Governor Sam Brownback, and some of you may already know of him, was Trump's pick for a religious persecution watchdog post called Ambassador for Religious Freedom. He will lead the Office of International Religious Freedom under the State Department, which monitors how people of religion are treated across the globe. This is going to be a key position.
It will be, and it's nice to know that the administration, regardless of what you think personally of the president or his party, that this administration at least is trying to do something to protect religious freedom. In Los Angeles, Planned Parenthood has found a new way to raise money, a drag queen bingo night.
You've heard everything now, right?
Yeah, to raise money for abortion. You've just seen some of the pictures that came along with this thing. The event is consisted of men caked with makeup and dressed as women, calling out bingo numbers and insulting attendees as cheating blank whores. But I guess this is...
Who wouldn't want to attend this
yeah,
event?
That's something that I think... Yeah.
My.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have from Mexico City, Radical Feminist Bomb Mexican Bishops Conference, but no one was injured. Anarchist website Contra Info posted a statement from a group calling itself the Informal Feminist Command of Anti-Authoritarian Action. They said they planted the bomb on July 25th for every torture and murder in the name of your God.
Wow. Interesting.
The saddest part was this mention that they had someone dressed up as the Blessed Virgin staging a fake abortion on a woman. It was just, to me, that's so offensive.
Yeah, it is. It is. And finally, we have the military archbishop is defending Trump's ban on new transgender soldiers. The archbishop for the Military Services USA, and you know, the Military Services has its own ordinary, its own archbishop. The archbishop there issued a statement defending President Trump's announcement that the U.S. military would no longer accept transgender individuals because of the tremendous medical costs and disruption it causes. The statement by the Reverend Timothy P. Borglio, I think is how I pronounce it, went directly beyond the 140 character limits that Trump had in announcing it on Twitter to outline the best possible rationale for the newly announced policy. While acknowledging the wisdom of banning service of transgender individuals because of the detriment to military readiness and the cost, the Archbishop went on further, offering a Catholic perspective on transgenderism and whatever. So Trump did pick up a little bit of support from one archbishop, anyway, for that, who deals directly with that. And with that, we are just about out of time here, so let's end with our defender's prayer. St. Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle, be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray, and do thou, Prince of the Heavenly Host, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all the evil spirits who prowl about the world seeking the ruin of souls. Amen. That's it for today. Thank you for listening. And as usual, if you have any comments or questions, you can contact me at Deacon Mike at iowacatholicradio.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook and check out our blog, Faith on Trial Radio, to keep up with what's going on in the area of religious freedom. And remember, Iowa Catholic Radio is a listener-supported station, and you can help us stay on the air. Go to iowacatholicradio.com to find out how you can help. Stay tuned now for Christ is the Answer with Father John Ricardo, which is next for Faith on Trial. This is your host, Deacon Mike Mano, wishing you a blessed and peaceful week.
Thanks.
Faith on Trial with Defender of the Faith, Deacon Mike Mano, is adjourned until next Tuesday at 10 a.m. and 10 p.m.
Faith on Trial with Deacon Mike Mano is underwritten by Confluence Brewing Company, located off the bike trail south of Grays Lake, 1235 Thomas Beck Road. Learn more at confluencebrewing.com.
Thank you, Farm Bureau agent Cindy Schulte, for underwriting Catholic Women Now. As an authorized independent agent, Cindy's team can provide health insurance options from Wellmark Blue Cross Blue Shield of Iowa. Cindy Schulte at 1315 50th Street in West Des Moines or on the web at cindyschulte.com. 515-226-2111. Cindy and her team know health insurance.
Wellmark Blue Cross Blue Shield of Iowa is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. Products available at Farm Bureau Financial Services.
Strength, stability, service, and Robert Cota. That's what you can count on with Farm Bureau Financial Services. Robert Cota, your Farm Bureau agent in Central Iowa, here to help people like you through all stages of life. He can make it simple to help protect what is most important to you, your family, cars, home, and future. Farm Bureau makes insurance simple. Robert Cota, 515-961-4555 or online at robert.cota@fbfs.com.
Farm Bureau Life Insurance Company, Farm Bureau Property and Casualty Insurance Company.